welcome to the Animation Podcast, a weekly podcast about all things animation brought to you by Filmbook. My name is Matt Brunet, but some of you may know me as Animat from my YouTube channel, Electric Dragon 505, home of web series that are all about animation, including Animation Look Back and Animat's Reviews.
All right. I'm going to stop the weird bureaucratic thing. I don't know why I decided to start off with it, but screw it. All right, anyways, if this is your first time here in the Animation Podcast, the title will go and explain everything for you. This is the Animation Podcast. You got it? Great. All right, good. On we go. But specifically, it talks about the latest news that happened this week. So, to start things off in this episode in particular, we are going to begin with something that will make your dreams come true. And then afterwards, we will be looking at a brand new computer that might change the way that computers are going to be made, and soon what will be the standard, probably, of computers for artists and animators and all that kind of stuff. Then afterwards, we will be looking at two release dates that decided to switch with itself, and everybody is pretty much hyped up about it. Then afterwards, we will be looking into an animated film based on a video game, and finally, we will look into Matt's Pick of the Week. If you want to check out more episodes of the Animation Podcast, then head on down to Filmbook, that is film-book.com, by searching The Animation Podcast. You can also email us at podcast@filmbook.com with The Animation Podcast in the subject line. Okay, so first things first. We are going to be looking into a brand new show that has been announced this week, and it's pretty much tapped upon many people's nostalgia. So I decided, you know what? Let's sing it here, folks. Muppet Babies will make your dreams come true. Muppet Babies will make your dreams come true. Yes, folks. Muppet Babies coming back on Disney Junior. All right, anyways. Okay, so yes, Muppet Babies is going to make a great big comeback on Disney Junior, as the channel has announced that they will be making a revival of the series coming to 2018. So the info that has been given, going into my source here in Variety, the new CG animated revival will, like the original, be geared towards children ages 4 and 7 and feature two 11-minute adventures per episode. The show will be a co-production between Disney Junior, Disney Consumer Products, and Interactive Media's Content and Media Group, along with The Muppet Studios. Going more into it, what the people have said, we are proud and a little bit giddy to begin production on our new version of the much-loved Muppet Babies, says Nancy Cantor, Executive Vice President, Original Programming, and General Manager at Disney Junior Worldwide. Parents will delight in seeing their favorite Muppets in the mixed animation style they remember from the original series, and kids will be introduced to this warm and zany world made just right for the Disney Junior audience. But on top of that, Debbie McClellan, the vice president of Muppet Studios, stated, "Bringing Muppet Babies to Disney Junior is a wonderful opportunity to reach a new generation of viewers to the creatively built Building Muppet Babies to Disney Junior is wonderfully, I don't know what's wrong with me, guys. Okay, one more time, take three. Bringing Muppet Babies to Disney Junior is a wonderful opportunity to reach a new generation of viewers and to creatively build on the innovative original series. We hope to engage and delight the nostalgic fans while also entertaining new kids, parents, and diverse audience through the heart and humor as only the Muppets can deliver." So, as you guys may know, for those of you who do know me as Animat on my YouTube channel and all that kind of stuff, you know that I am a huge Muppet fan. Currently, I'm doing a series now, The Muppet Vlogs, which goes into each episode of the original Muppet Show, and I've already done reviews of the 2011 Muppets movie and Muppets Most Wanted as well. So I'm definitely a big Muppet fan, but when it comes to Muppet Babies, it's not really much of my forte. I'm not necessarily the kind of person who actually did grow up with Muppet Babies. keep in mind, yes, I am a huge Muppets fan, but I'm also born in the 90s, and Muppet Babies was from the 80s, so I didn't really watch it as much. I've seen plenty of the other stuff, like mostly Cartoon Network shows, and maybe like a few other series that did come from the 80s, like Inspector Gadget and the Smurfs, but that's mostly it. So I'm not entirely hyped up about it. I've barely even seen much episodes of Muppet Babies, to be very honest. I think the most that I've seen is probably Cartoon All-Stars to the Rescue, and that's pretty much it. But the one thing I do know about Muppet Babies is that it really was a revolutionary show that made a huge impact and started this huge trend. I can recall, because that actually happened during my time, that like afterwards, especially with Hanna-Barbera, that they would take popular properties and they would turn them much younger, like either as babies or as kids. Like, it spun off a lot of TV shows like Flintstones Kids. I remember watching a lot of A Pup Named Scooby-Doo. There was also Baby Looney Tunes. Sometimes it doesn't have to be like a TV show. It can go into marketing as well, like taking properties and just sell toys and all that kind of stuff. Just turn them into babies, like with baby Disney characters, where you have like Baby Mickey, Baby Minnie, Baby Donald, and Baby Goofy. But there's also like other TV shows I can think of that they turned them into kids, like Tom and Jerry Kids. Maybe Yo Yogi can count on that as well, but I don't know if that would count, because that's just taking Hanna-Barbera characters and turn them into 90s kids, literally. Like, watching it nowadays, it's too 90s even for me. My God, it's ridiculous with its cheese. But going into Muppet Babies, like, the fact that it is making a comeback, you know, it actually is pretty nice to see, considering that you could tell that nowadays Disney is taking the Muppets a lot more seriously, and they really want to push that the Muppets are making a comeback, and they do recognize that it is a huge brand, so they really do want to sell it. I mean, technically, yes, the 2015 Muppets didn't necessarily do so well. Like, some people enjoyed it, while others, they kind of have issues with it, including, like, the adult humor and all that kind of stuff. I will admit, it's not the best series out there. There have been a lot of better Muppet series, but it's not the worst either. There are some criticisms that I will admit I did not understand people whatsoever. Like, when they would say that, oh, this is not the Kermit that I remember. Yeah, this is still the same Kermit no matter what. He just grew some balls. That's the freaking difference. You don't know Kermit like I know Kermit. But yeah, other than that, going into the 2015 series, technically that did not go so well, and ABC unfortunately canceled it. But even nowadays, actually, in other venues, they are trying to make the Muppets a lot more prominent, especially in Walt Disney World. I forgot the full title of it, but at Walt Disney World, in the Magic Kingdom, there's actually a new show that does feature the Muppets called Great Moments in America with the Muppets, which features the main ones, basically, with Kermit, Miss Piggy, Fozzie, Gonzo, some of the chickens. And, of course, since you're talking about America, you have to add in Sam the Eagle. On top of that, Dr. Bunsen, Honeydew, and Beaker, a roaming audio animatronic. It was in, a few years ago, they tried to test that out, but then it disappeared. But somehow it actually did make a comeback at Epcot. And in the original hub that the Muppets have always been in Walt Disney World, at Hollywood Studios, where they have Muppet Vision 3D, which I gotta say is my favorite Disney World attraction, period. At Muppet Vision 3D, they actually expanded the area. Now it actually does belong to the Muppets. Beforehand, the attraction used to be in a section called Streets of America, but now it's actually called, I think it's like either Muppet Avenue or something like that, but now it's actually devoted to the Muppets. And on top of that, the pizzeria that used to be a Pizza Planet next to Muppet Vision 3D has now been transformed into a more New York theme, and now it has become like Rizzo's Pizzeria, on top of having other Muppet elements. And I actually saw online that they even did some renovations at the pre-show queue at Muppet Vision 3D, and it honestly really got me all excited, and I really want to go back to Walt Disney World now to experience the new Muppet Vision 3D. Like, oh my god, I am so hyped up. It actually looks amazing. But yeah, this is all to say that Disney is taking the Muppets a lot more seriously nowadays, and they do recognize that it is a recognizable brand, and how nowadays, like, people don't really see the Muppets like Kermit, Fozzie, Gonzo, or Miss Piggy as like puppets or anything like that. They are now treated as actual celebrities. They're no different than like Whoopi Goldberg or Bette Midler or any of those people. You know, they're actual celebrities. They feel like actual people, and that's how they've become nowadays. They are pretty much actual celebrities, and now with the addition of Muppet Babies. You know, it at least it's another new take. I remember actually on Twitter, I kind of joked a little bit that, oh, Muppet Babies is coming back. Now compact with the 2015 adult humor and having that pig. I forgot her name. I think Denise, the pig that nobody cared about from that series. I joked a bit, but yeah, it's not true. But yeah, seeing that they are going to try another take on a TV show, it's going to be pretty nice. And, you know, I am pretty glad that Disney is, you know, trying to flourish the Muppet franchise, basically, with it. And I got to say, looking into the series itself, with what they've done, the only thing that we can see so far is just a picture. And wow, so far it is CG, but it does actually look pretty realistic. Like, you can actually see, like, they worked hard on, like, the little textures on Kermit or on Fozzie or even Miss Piggy. It's actually pretty interesting. Now, we haven't seen any clips so far of it, what it looks like. But am I going to be watching this series? Well, honestly, no, because, like, it's Disney Junior, so it's pretty much geared towards kids, so I don't really need to go and watch that, basically. But yeah, actually, for those of you who don't know, where the fridge did Muppet Babies come from? Actually, it has a very interesting story, because Muppet Babies did not just come out as like a bunch of executives saying, hey, let's take the Muppets and turn them into babies and let's make a TV show out of it. No. The origin of it is actually very interesting, because it all began in Muppets Take Manhattan, where there is actually one bit where they all reflect back when they were kids, and there was like an entire musical number where we see all the Muppets as babies, and that's where Muppet Babies came from. They decided to take that musical number and turn that into an entire animated series, and I guess the rest is the rest is history as one of the most popular TV shows of the 80s. Now that it's making a comeback, it's going to be pretty interesting to see how they're going to do with it. Is it going to be good? Is it going to be bad? I don't know. Usually Disney Junior is not necessarily my forte. Maybe it can actually go as well as Jake and the Neverland Pirates, where it's actually pretty successful and they are taking elements from a previous Disney property. Like, for those of you who don't know, Jake and the Neverland Pirates is basically taken from Disney's Peter Pan, where it's actually complete with Captain Hook and Mr. Smee from the 1953 animated feature. So, are they going to do justice with Muppet Babies? Who knows, but we shall see when it will be appearing on Disney Junior in 2018. Now, for our next story, we're going to take a little break from animation, and this is going to be for all the artists and the animators and all the creative people who are listening to the animation podcast. This one is going to be especially for you, because we are going to be diving into a bit of technology. And this is just a little bit of a heads up, because maybe in the future, like in 5-10 years, this could actually be the norm to animators and creators in terms of having their computer. Now, out of all the companies out there, apparently it is Microsoft that actually announced this brand new computer called Surface Studio. And they even showed, my stomach is not necessarily cooperating with me now. Okay, now it is. Okay, but anyways, going back into it, they have announced that they have this brand new computer called the Surface Studio. And if I may read a little bit into it about what it is, going into my source here in Cartoon Brew, with i5 and i7 Intel Core processors and NVIDIA GeForce graphics card, the Surface Studio is ready for heavy-duty graphics work. It has a hinge that allows the users to easily tilt the screen for an upright angle down to a nearly flat angle for drawing. Its centerpiece, a 28-inch screen that Microsoft says is the world's thinnest LCD monitor ever built, has a 10-point multi-touch and 4,500 times 3,000 resolution, higher than 4K, easily besting any offering from Wacom's Cintiq line. So basically what this computer is that it looks like a MacBook, but the screen is also touchscreen, and you can actually go and draw on it. You can do whatever you wish. And on top of that, it also offers this extra little thing, like not just a pencil, but going back into my source, as impressive as the Surface Studio looks, its most revolutionary aspect isn't the computer itself, but rather the accompanying $100 puck-like peripheral Surface Dial, a physical scroll wheel with haptic feedback that aims to change the way artists interact with technology by creating a more natural and physical experience. The Dial, which was a big hit with the tech community at its unveiling today, is most easily understood when seen in action. Basically, what this Dial is that you could pretty much put it on the screen. Like, it's not just a little puck that you can use as your mouse. Like, you will have a mouse, but technically, like, you could do it if you like the laptop style, just moving around with your finger. But you can actually put it on the screen, and you can actually use it as a dial if you want to go and change some of the aspects of your pen when you're drawing. Like, you could change the colors, you could pretty much change the brush styles. Like, it has that option for you. And a lot, and pretty much the early reactions of it when people are announced, they're pretty much hyped up for it, but they are saying that it is possible that it could actually kill off Wacom's business. Not necessarily Wacom's, or actually, yeah, a lot of people are saying that this could kill off Wacom, but specifically for the Wacom Cintiq. And that's basically the biggest thing about the Surface Studio, is that it is simultaneously not just a computer, but also it's a tablet, like a large tablet that you can draw on it. So you don't have to have like a separate computer and have a Cintiq as well. So you can pretty much have both. And that is pretty much the key element. But there are some criticisms as well that do come with it. Like when I'm looking down into the comments section of this thread, some people are saying that for the longest time they have their Cintiq. Like it's what they use for drawing their, drawing their art and stuff like that. Like even though it is big and bulky and it's pretty much the size as a monitor back in the 90s, you know, they still use it for a very long time. It's still good after all these years. And they can still keep it after they would change computer from time to time. So it is possible that they'll just change the same computer. But the way that I see it in the future, it could be possible that Wacom could just die off. And this is going to be the norm in terms of computers for artists and animators that, like, as I stated before, it's pretty surprising that out of all freaking companies, it is Microsoft that actually build up something that seems pretty revolutionary for artists and animators. Usually, we would expect this for a company like Apple to do this, but no, it turns out to be Microsoft. But I can actually imagine in the future that there are going to be other companies like Apple that are going to come in, and they want to try to follow with this idea. They want to try this out to make a computer that is simultaneously a tablet. And soon there would no longer be a need for Wacom tablets. Like, this is going to be the main feature. And even though this is heavily geared towards artists and animators, I can imagine sometime in the future, there will be a time that, they'll try to figure this out for other uses, technically for non-artistic parts that other people can actually use to go expand their market. But yeah, what we are seeing here could be the future. Now, rather, if people are going to switch their Cintiq or whatever their Wacom tablets and use it on their computer, maybe it could be a good idea. But this could actually be a pretty good investment that I can imagine in the future. Like, if there's an aspiring animator or an aspiring artist, eventually what they want to do is that they want to go and work on their computer to actually make a lot of digital art. It could be pretty expensive when you would go get your computer and then you would get you would go and get a giant Wacom Cintiq. Like, it could pretty much build up, but now that they can have both at the same time with a large screen that they can just draw, and they would have their little Surface dial to change the colors and stuff like that, it sounds like a dream for them. Like, why spend so many on different things when you can just spend on just this one element that has all the gear for you? Now, specifically as a computer itself, who knows? Like, apparently you can get it in different formats. Like, it's not necessarily big. Apparently it says here for Surface Studio that the memory, it only holds like 8 gig, 16 gig, or 32 gig of RAM. Or I don't know if that's actually the capacity that it holds, but I can imagine eventually maybe a company like... Actually, here it is. Oh, the storage. Sorry, that's... Okay, no. I don't know why I thought that, but... Oh, okay. Oh, no, it actually is a legit computer, because you can actually get it either as... it has a storage of either 1 terabyte or 2 terabytes, so it can actually work as well as a computer. Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. Yeah, this could actually be a game changer, but... You guys should actually keep an eye on something like the Surface, because I can imagine other companies like Apple, they're going to go and copy on it, and they will make something like this where it's going to be a mixture of both a computer and your tablet to go draw on it. And who knows? It'll depend on the it'll depend on the sales, if artists and animators will want to buy this. If they will accept to take away their Cintiq and replace it with this entire computer, that'll pretty much be a combination of both at once. So is it going to be a good thing? Is it going to be a bad thing? Who knows? It'll all depend on the artist, if they are willing to spend their money to have everything they have at once instead of having two separate things. If they're going to be more fruitful and they decide to keep their Cintiq, or they want to ultimately switch up their computer to have the new technology, who knows? But it'll also depend on the execution, how well the Surface is going to work out. Is it going to be the brand new tool for artists? Who knows? Nobody knows if this is actually going to work out, if it works as well as it advertises. I don't know. So far, we just got the announcement, but this could potentially be the next big thing. There is a chance that this could pretty much end off the business of Wacom, or they'll just discontinue Cintiq. Who knows what's going to happen? But yeah, if you're interested in purchasing the Surface, well, they're going to charge it. It's not going to be cheap. The starting price is so far $3,000, no joke. And they will, what it says here, Microsoft will start shipping the Surface Studio in limited quantities this holiday season, followed by general availability in 2017, but you can pre-order it now on Microsoft's website. Okay, so for our next story, this is just a tiny bit of news that it's just like a small irrelevant thing that they just switched one thing with another, but my God, it just made massive buzz online. Like, everybody pretty much freaked out, and it's only half of the news that everybody just got excited, and it's pretty much what's going on at Pixar. The only thing that they have done is that they have switched the release dates of Toy Story 4 and The Incredibles 2. So previously, The Incredibles 2 was going to be released in 2019, and Toy Story 4 was going to be released in 2018. But now that they decided to switch it up, The Incredibles 2 will now be released in the summer of 2018, while Toy Story 4 is going to be coming out in 2019. So the biggest thing that pretty much happened was that everybody got so excited over the fact that now we are getting The Incredibles 2, the most anticipated sequel of all time so far. We're going to be getting that a year earlier than expected. So everybody pretty much got hyped up, and nobody really gave much of a crap for Toy Story 4. And, you know, I was looking at it, and, you know, I kind of followed the crowd a bit. I was excited to know that we are going to get Incredibles 2 early, so that is definitely fantastic. But a part of me did wonder, why is this going on? So I looked into it, and the most that I got, going into my source here at Oh My Disney, John Lasseter, who is also going to be the director of Toy Story 4, stated, "We love these characters so much. They are like family to us. I mean, they are kind of the characters that really did build Pixar into what it is today. So I definitely do understand that. But going more into it, we don't want to do anything with them unless it lives up to or surpasses what's gone before. Toy Story 3 ended Woody and Buzz's story with Andy so perfectly that for a long time, we never even talked about doing another Toy Story movie. But when Andrew, Pete, and Lee, which by the way is Andrew Stanton, Pete Docter, and Lee Unkrich, and I came up with this new idea, I just could not stop thinking about it. It was so exciting to me. I knew we had to make this movie, and I wanted to direct it myself." So basically what John Lasseter has stated, he didn't go directly with it, but what he is trying to say is that there are some complications with the story. They're not necessarily satisfied with what they got, and they want to try to build it a little bit better. So that's why they are delaying it until 2019. Which did get me a little bit concerned about Toy Story 4. I mean, yeah, just want to say right now that this bit of news is going to be more about, or at least I'm going to be talking more about Toy Story 4 than The Incredibles 2, because I'll be honest, I've already covered what has to be said about The Incredibles 2. We're going to get it a year earlier than expected. We're going to get it at 2018, so that's, as of now, actually a year and a half, so hip hip hooray. But I want to focus a little bit more on Toy Story 4. And yes, I understand what people are saying, that they're not necessarily as excited about Toy Story 4 because technically there shouldn't even be a Toy Story 4. Like John Lasseter said himself, Toy Story 3 ended Woody and Buzz's story with Andy so perfectly that for a long time, they never even talked about doing another Toy Story movie. And I completely agree. I mean, Toy Story 3 was, like, back that, like, honestly, back when it was released, when I could think about it, it was the biggest movie. And even among my friends, it was pretty much the biggest thing that was released so far. It was the ultimate summer event of 2010. And it honestly, it was just absolutely phenomenal when I was watching it. And by the way, I just want to mention, like, just a little bit of a background, that me and my friends, since we are born in the early 90s, we have seen Toy Story in theaters. I can even tell you personally that I actually legit saw the first Toy Story in theaters back in 1995. I was legitimately there. So you guys, like, maybe some of you don't know Toy Story as much as I do, just saying. But yeah, just watching Toy Story 3 and the fact that Andy grew up with us, it was just like, it, like, not only was it an amazing movie, but it was also such a personal movie for us. And like, we couldn't think of a better ending for it. It was just absolutely phenomenal and hands down one of the best Pixar movies that they have ever done. My God, it's just beautiful. And plus the fact that it is a historical animated feature, considering that it is the first ever animated film that surpassed $1 billion at the box office and also got a nomination for Best Picture. Technically, it doesn't really count, considering that it just got the nomination because the Academy Awards was doing its big thing of listing like 8 or 9 or even 10 movies for Best Picture. Doesn't necessarily count as much as when Beauty and the Beast got it, but still, at least it has it among many other nominations, and it did win one for Best Animated Feature, but that's kind of a given, let's be honest. But yeah, going back into this, going into Toy Story 4, I understand that a lot of people are not necessarily excited. And yeah, I kind of do agree. Technically, we shouldn't have, like, we don't necessarily need a Toy Story 4. But if John Lasseter, what he's indirectly telling us is true, and that they are having a bit of complications with the story, to the point that they're not having it the way that they want it to be really, really good, it does make me worried a bit, because when you look back recently with the production troubles with several of their movies, that doesn't mean things are going to go well for the final product in itself. Like, when you look into movies like Brave or The Good Dinosaur, they did not end up being as good as many of the other Pixar movies, like Finding Nemo or The Incredibles or WALL-E. Like, they're still good movies in itself. It's just they're not as good of a Pixar movie per se. And just because that they have these, you know, story troubles and things aren't necessarily going well, and that they ended up getting delayed a bit, like with The Good Dinosaur, I think it was supposed to be released in 2014, but then it got delayed into 2015. Things didn't go well with The Good Dinosaur, and it unfortunately ended up as Pixar's first flop at the box office. But there actually is a bit of a difference, however. When you think about Brave and The Good Dinosaur, they actually got their directors replaced. Like, Brenda Chapman got replaced by Mark Andrews, or Bob Peterson got replaced by Peter Son. I highly doubt that they're going to do the same thing with Toy Story 4. I mean, considering that John Lasseter is one of the big bosses at Pixar, I don't think that they are going to try to switch him up. I don't think, like, the people at Pixar are going to go to him saying, yeah, we don't know what you're doing, you're going to be replaced. No. But, you know, it is a bit concerning for me still, because this is technically not the first time that Toy Story 4 is being delayed. If you guys remember back last year at D23, they announced that Toy Story 4 would be released in 2017. But then shortly afterwards, they had to switch the release date with Cars 3, which is why now Cars 3 is going to be released next year in 2017. But now we got this happening again, where Toy Story 4 has to be delayed another year to be released in 2019. However, I just want to mention this. Even though things don't necessarily go, things don't necessarily seem to be looking well for Toy Story 4, and a lot of people are probably expecting, like, oh, because they have troubles, this is going to suck, this is going to be the worst Toy Story movie, da-da-da-da-da. Don't ever say that this might end up sucking, because you never know. And just recently, Pixar has proved that even though we didn't ask for a sequel like that, it can actually turn out very well. And what I mean by that is, if you guys don't, if you guys need proof that Toy Story 4 might actually turn out to be a really good movie, take a look at Finding Dory. I don't know any single person who really demanded for a Finding Nemo sequel, other than Ellen DeGeneres. I don't know anybody who thought, you know what, we need another movie of Finding Nemo, because everybody was pretty much focusing on The Incredibles to have a sequel. And how can you really make a movie, like a follow-up film to Finding Nemo? Seriously. I mean, like, it's pretty much built to the point that it's made as a standalone movie. So how can you do it? But apparently, Andrew Stanton and the people at Pixar actually did find a way to make it more about Dory. And it actually turned out to be extremely good. Not just, like, not just really good, actually, but it actually ended up making $1 billion at the box office, the second Pixar film to do so. So, you never know. If Finding Dory actually turned out really well, despite nobody really asking for a sequel of it, maybe Toy... Oh, sorry about that. My stomach is not cooperating with me well. But anyways, maybe Toy Story 4 might actually turn out well. And you never know. Like, I remember way back in the beginning when it used to be, like, a Toy Story 4 used to be a joke. I remember in Muppets Most Wanted, one of the jokes that Gonzo made, like, he would come out, like, going, "We're doing a sequel, the studio wants more, while they wait for Tom Hanks and makes Toy Story 4. You know, I used to think that was just a joke, but apparently he wasn't kidding. This is a legit thing that is going on. But yeah, like, who knows? Maybe they might actually have a pretty good idea. And, you know, the backstory that John Lasseter just gave us, it actually does give me a bit more confidence that it could actually turn out to be pretty good. The reason for that is because the way that John Lasseter explained that Toy Story 4, how it actually came up to be, like when he was talking with Andrew, Pete, and Lee, it does remind me of the teaser trailer for WALL-E. If you guys don't remember it, it was actually really, really cool, where the director, Andrew Stanton, he was pretty much talking to the audience about this restaurant that they would go to, and that one day they thought up of numerous ideas of movies, where it was the place where they thought up of A Bug's Life, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, Toy Story 2, and all those movies, and then they thought up about WALL-E. And, you know, like, maybe this is another scenario that's just like that. If that conversation over there brought us so many great films, maybe this conversation could actually bring us something great as well, considering that, like, it is coming from the minds of, like, some of the greatest creative heads of animation, with Andrew Stanton, Pete Docter, Lee Unkrich, and John Lasseter. Who knows? Like, maybe this could actually turn out great and something worthy to be a part of the Toy Story movies. So, who knows? But yeah, all this to say that I'm sure you guys are pretty much marking your calendars right now on June 15th, 2018 for the big comeback of The Incredibles. But in terms of Toy Story 4, if you are still interested in maybe seeing it, it will be released on June 21st, 2019. Now, going into our next story, we are going to be looking into a video game. Not necessarily a big video game, but it does have a bit of a following. Are some of you familiar with Klonoa? It was pretty much a franchise made by Bandai Namco. But apparently, it turns out at TIFFCOM and at the Tokyo Film Festival, they have announced that they are going to be making a Klonoa movie. And going into my source here at Variety, it has stated Henshin founder Rob Pereda will produce, as Hitoshi Ariga will script the film as well as serve as co-producer and character designer, a bit like what he did in the Klonoa video games. For those of you who don't know who Hitoshi Ariga is, let me explain a little bit more. You might actually find him familiar, or at least you are definitely familiar with his works. Ariga previously served as a character designer on the Pokemon series, among others, while Pereda worked at Bandai Namco as a producer at such titles as Bravo Man, Mappy, and Wonder Momo. So far, we don't know if there's going to be a release date or when they are going to start it. We know that there's going to be an animated feature based on Klonoa. And you know, this is actually a pretty good sign that this could actually turn out to be pretty good, considering that they do have the people who are involved with the games more attached to it, because that's pretty much the biggest problems when you think back at most of the almost all of the movies based on video games. They're not as attached to the company that was making it. Like, a recent example is Ratchet & Clank. The most that they got was one of the writers of Ratchet & Clank decided to jump in and be one of the writers onto Ratchet & Clank. And it turned out to be, well, pretty much bad. Not only bad, but it bombed at the box office, only making $10 million. And that same writer would go on to pretty much just blame everyone else except for him for the bad writing. Seriously, he doesn't want to go and take responsibility. Maybe for the good parts, but not for the bad. Like, the bad parts, oh, that's everyone else's fault. Yeah, you're just trying to save your career, you moron. But anyways, yeah, now that they actually do have some of the people involved, like Rob Pareda and especially Hitoshi Ariga playing a big part as not only a writer, but as a producer and the character designer, like, it does give me a good sign that they will definitely stay true to the spirit of Klonoa. Like I said before, personally, I've never played the games myself. I have heard about it before, but going into my source here, I just want to know a little bit, like, Variety didn't really write much on it. It just says, first launched in 1997, the Klonoa series relates the adventures of the cat-like Klonoa and his pals through a dream world. From what I've heard, I don't know if this is true, but I think, like, it's more of a story-driven kind of game. In fact, let me actually do a little bit of research. I think it's, like, some kind of platformer or puzzle solver. I just want to just get more info about what the fridge. Okay, there we go. Yeah, I just want to know a little bit more, like, what the fridge is this? But apparently, yeah, I'm gonna go on my the source here on Wikipedia if it says anything. I don't know what the fridge says. It's a platform game. Okay, so it's more of a platformer. Yeah, and like I said, it is pretty story driven, and it's mostly like it you see that there is a cat and he has on his hat Pac-Man, and it actually is a combining effort with Namco, and they did collaborate with Capcom, but yeah, that's most that I could say so far. Like, if I need more info on it, I'd probably have to go and play some of the games. But yeah, this is all to say, for those of you who are fans of Klonoa, there is going to be an animated feature of it, and Ariga will be involved with the film as the character designer, writer, and producer. When is it going to be released? I don't know, but eventually in the future, maybe in 2019, maybe 2020. That's most that I could probably expect. The earliest that I can think of is maybe late 2018, but who knows? And so, finally, we now have Matt's Pick of the Week! And with this one, this is something that really touches upon my specific interests. It's not just on animation, but it goes into the history of animation. And let me just explain to you guys about the schools in animation, like some of the most well-known ones. Of course, some of you may be more familiar, some of the more popular schools are actually in Canada, not in the US, with Sheridan is a highly popular one and a highly rated one, and also Van Arts, considering that Vancouver is a pretty large hub for animation. Of course, a place like Van Arts could actually be popular, but I think in the animation community, hands down, if you gotta ask anyone what is the most popular animation school, it has to be CalArts, the one that Walt Disney has founded in the 60s to go and build up new animators that used to be taught by some of Walt's legendary animators like the Nine Old Men. And apparently one of the teachers in there, Maureen Furness, decided to take her class and pretty much put it in a book for the public to see, which is called A New History of Animation. So you guys might be wondering, what is A New History of Animation? Basically, Maureen Furness, she actually teaches the history of animation at CalArts. So she decided to take her class, put all the key notes on the history of animation, and put it in this one big book. We don't know if it's going to be released yet, but let me go a little bit in my source here about the description of the new history of animation. Taking my source here from Cartoon Brew, of course, it says, a new history of animation, a new history of animation guides readers, excuse me, stomach, seriously, I'm trying to read here. A new history of animation guides readers through the history and context of animation from around the world. The book assures no prior knowledge on the subject and explains all the key technical concepts, filling a gap at the market for a complete and well-researched animation history textbook that can be used by teachers in trade schools and universities worldwide, as well as by readers interested in the story of this evolving medium, aka people like me. Topics covered include early cinema and the foundations of the animation industry, animation as modern art, and the emergence to the major studio, animation during wartime, stop motion, new audiences for animation in advertising, television, and games, animation from Eastern Europe, short films, computer-generated animation, international animation from Japan and elsewhere, and animation as an art form. So basically, this is going, like, basically what Maureen Furness wants to do with this is make it the next big animation book, make it the next big most wanted, like, if you want to be an animator, you got to have this book as much as something like The Animator Survival Kit by Richard Williams or The Illusion of Life by Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston. And absolutely, this is something that really does keen to my interest. As someone who is interested, like, as the guy who made Animation Look Back, this is something that I am pretty interested in. And on top of that, Cartoon Brew even posted this little advertising video about it with Maureen Furness explaining about what this is all about. And it is pretty interesting to know, like, what it, like, you know, having this book explaining, like, the key notes on the history of animation and how it affects on different types of mediums, not, like, with computers, with Japan, with games, and all that kind of stuff. And apparently right now you can actually, can get it on Amazon, and, well, it's not necessarily cheap. It's not expensive, but it is, you know, it, like, you do have to save up a tiny bit. Right now, if you want to buy, like, if you want to buy it, like, fresh right now, apparently they only have it on paperback, which I am a little bit disappointed. I would love to see it if it can be on hardcover, but you can actually get it for the total of $67, or there are other areas that they sell it for $60. So around, like, between $60 to $70. It's a little bit expensive for, you know, it's expensive for a book, but still, for something that does cover the entire history on animation, it really does get your bang for your buck. And, you know, thinking about it, when you think of it, like, some of you might expect, like, hasn't this book exist already? Like, there's a book that covers on the history of animation. Well, here's the thing. Like, animation has such a huge history that it really does depend on which aspect of the history that you're talking about. There are plenty of books that are pretty much just devoted to just certain aspects of it, and they could have fewer pages. Like, the new history of animation, it has a total of, like, what it says here, 464 pages. There are some that could have that, and that only touches upon a part of the aspect. Like, there are some that only cover animation done at Disney. There are some that cover on certain time periods, like, you know, rather it be in the 50s or in the 60s or in the 80s or in the 90s. There are some that just cover on television or just cover on movies. You know, there are these aspects of it, but there's not one that covers the entirety of it and make, like, putting in just the key notes on what's up with that history, like, to give you the basic picture. And it wouldn't surprise me that this is going to be the next big book that a lot of people are going to be using. Like, I can definitely see in universities when they're teaching the history of animation that they'll actually use this and to go to different pages to explain this part of the history. It depends how length or how in-depth it goes. If they just put in the key notes into it, like the little aspects, who knows? Like, I don't know if it would be as useful or how much that it goes in depth, but considering that it has more than 450 pages, it would probably go into a lot of it. But yeah, but I think the biggest selling point for many people who want to go into animation is the fact that you actually have an entire CalArts course into a book that's being released publicly. I think that could be the big selling point that people would be appealed to. It's that factor that you would actually get something from CalArts. And, you know, that could actually be pretty impressive. And that's actually pretty appealing from what I see. And like I said, as the guy who actually made Animation Look Back, I would definitely be interested to have this book of the new history of animation, you know, to expand my knowledge a bit, to see, like, what's up in the world of animation, how things have been formed. Like, you know, this could actually be a very interesting book. I don't know. Oh, crap. Yeah, I just noticed, I don't know how I missed that, but I just noticed this right now, that as I'm recording this, it's temporarily out of stock. So, yeah, this is pretty much a big book that a lot of people would want to get. So, whenever it's available, you better get it while it's hot, because, oh boy, this could actually be pretty big. So, yeah, I would definitely be interested in getting this. And considering that Christmas is around the corner, many animation fans would probably want to put this on their Christmas list. So, who knows? Yeah, if you guys are interested in getting a new history on animation, just you know, add that to your cart or on your wish list on Amazon and see how it goes from there, because I'm actually pretty interested to see what this book has in store. And that will pretty much be it for this week. So I just want to say thank you guys so much for listening to this episode of the Animation Podcast. You can find more of my work at film-book.com. All you have to do is search for Matthew Brunette or the Animation Podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at animat505. Also, if you have listened to this podcast on iTunes or any other podcast service, do you mind doing us a little favor and rate and review this episode? That would be great. And if you are listening to this podcast on YouTube, then hit that little like button and leave us a little comment on your thoughts on the news this week. Tune in next week for the latest episode of the Animation Podcast and all things animation. Thank you guys so much for listening, and until next week, see you later, dudes!